My name is Sam Sundermeyer, and this is Dawn of the Long Night, Origin of Baseball's Color Barrier. Professional baseball is a child of Reconstruction-era America. The timing of the game's professional evolution concerning our post-bellum period is an essential piece of context. Within the twisted knot that came to be known as Reconstruction, freed men and women found themselves ensnared in restrictive labor practices. The capitalists that promoted these practices colluded to suppress black earnings and forced African Americans to create segregated industries that often lacked white industries' capital and opportunity. Organized baseball emulated these practices. To understand how the color barrier came to be in baseball, an examination of the black experience during Reconstruction and beyond is vital. As the game evolved from a fraternal association to a commercial cartel, restrictive labor practices permeated the game. They forced the African Americans out of organized baseball for over 60 years. The magnates in control of the highest levels of the game did not stand by and shrug their shoulders as Cap Anson and other players refused to play against black players and clubs. They reinforced player behavior by enacting business practices into the organized game that segregated the black ball player. Although the 13th Amendment declared that neither slavery nor involuntary servitude shall exist in the United States, freedmen's bureau contracts that freed men and women had but no choice to sign contained language reminiscent of the practices. The labor agreement, which is up here on the screen, for Trust B. Hall, which was signed in August 28, 1865, the labor agreement for Trust B. Hall, an emancipated slave, stated that he was to render Robert McKenzie true and faithful service and obey all lawful commands as he used to when a slave. Given the importance the Bureau placed on these labor contracts in their guise of implementing a free labor market across the war-torn South, these words carried immense weight. Bureau contracts stipulated that freed men and women were to, quote, do any kind of labor deemed necessary by the contract holder, who was often the former enslaver. As a result of these labor contracts and other forms of prejudice against African Americans, a segregated economic structure took root across the United States both during and after Reconstruction. These contracts, along with federal ambivalence and racism, combined to create a postbellum propaganda campaign against African Americans. In these derogatory efforts, black men, women, and children were cast as lazy, inept, and beyond the reach of education and rehabilitation. The black ball player was not immune from this campaign. Black teams were often expected to provide additional show beyond the action on the diamond. Describing the play of the Gorhams of New York in 1888, the Brooklyn Daily Eagle describes the chatter of the players as a, quote, laughable burlesque of the St. Louis style. In this, the Cuban Giants excel, and the Gorhams are well up in the business. Additionally, contemporary media played up derogatory propaganda against African-American ballplayers. Describing Fleet Walker and George Stovey, Newark's, quote, colored battery in 1887, the Daily Eagle felt the need to emphasize the fact that, quote, in fact, Newark's colored battery is a good one. A game between two colored teams made the Daily Eagle's police blotter on October 4th, 1867. The crowd was, quote, crowded with spectators of the colored persuasion who were exceedingly noisy. Frederick Douglass emphasized the role of this particular form of racism in American society with The Color Line, an article that was published in the North American Review in 1881. Quote, when this evil spirit is judge, jury, and prosecutor, nothing less than overwhelming evidence is sufficient to overcome the force of unfavorable presumptions. Everything against the person of the hated color is promptly taken for granted, while everything in his favor is received with suspicion and doubt. The reality was African Americans, both freed and enslaved, had a rich and enduring culture. African, English, Spanish, Arabic, Caribbean, indigenous, and American influences accumulated over hundreds and thousands of years had given a rise had given rise to a culture that proved impervious to bondage. Upon emancipation, black men and women began to assert themselves in their and their culture in public as who they were and had been all along, individual men and women created equal. This was the black ball player, Bud Fowler, Fleet Walker, George Stovey, Frank Grant. These players took their assertion, took place on what was becoming the great mirror of American society, the ball diamond. Stephen Gelber, in his article, Their Hands Are All Out Playing Business in Amateur Baseball in 1845 through 1917, cast the ball players of the 1860s as blue and white collar workers attempting to, quote, replicate and reinforce the work experiences that so many of them shared. If we can envision this interpretation, it would be applicable to view it, to view this diamond as colorless. In his landmark study, Free Blacks in Antebellum Philadelphia, Theodore Hirschberg discovered that the wealth for three out of every five households in the black community in 1847 amounted to $60 or less. In that same year, less than one half of 1% of the black male workforce held employment in Philadelphia factories. With industrialization rampant across the North and thousands of Irish immigrants entering the American factory workforce, black exclusion is evident in this instance. As the Southern oligarchy reemerged from the ashes of Reconstruction and spread about, black wage earners felt the grip of restraint. Across all industries, African Americans, along with poor whites and other ethnic groups, began to feel the effects of runaway capitalism. As the Gilded Age dawned, vast amounts of capital began to accumulate in but a few hands. Exploitation was rampant. W.E.B. Du Bois titled this a, quote, new capitalism. Du Bois saw high wage earners and political office uniting to exploit, quote, white, yellow, brown, and black labor in lesser hands. This representation of America in the factory and the workforce would soon spill over to the ball field. As such, the early organization of baseball fell along racial and class lines. During the immediate postbellum period, approximately two-thirds of Chicago urbanites who played baseball were white-collar workers. Skilled artisans made up the remaining third. The proletariat lacked the sufficient time, energy, and opportunity to play. Given the outright exclusion of African Americans in the upper and working classes during this time period, baseball would appear to be beyond their reach. Nonetheless, they played and they organized. In 1866, the Pythian Baseball Club of Philadelphia emerged as the top black club in the city. The club consisted of prominent white-collar African-Americans in Philadelphia, mirroring the makeup of white teams. Through the leadership of Octavius Cato and Jacob White, the Pythians played top-notch baseball, challenged white teams to interracial games, and fought for acceptance into the National Association of Baseball Players. The emergence of the Pythians coincided with the sparking of the professional game in urban centers, primarily New York. The social interest that had driven many players to the baseball fraternity was quickly eroding in the face of competition and commercial opportunity. The erosion partnered with prejudice to deny the Pythian Club entry into the National Association and set a precedent for the color barrier. In 1867, the Pythian Club attempted on two separate occasions to join what then consisted of organized baseball. These early amateur organizations were in the early stages of their professional evolution. In 1868, the National Association altered its representation system from club representatives to state associations. In 1869, the National Association adopted a separate rule defining amateur and professional players. By 1870, professionals were in firm control of the organized game, forming their own professional National Association a year later. It was this bureaucratic landscape that rejected the Pythian Club. In baseball, no longer was it the objective on the diamond to foster fraternity. The actions of the National Association make it clear that the game's purpose was to compete and to build capital. Power in baseball was condensing itself. The restructuring in 1868 is a representation of this practice. For decades, across nearly every industry and setting in the United States, capitalists had held prejudice toward and excluded African Americans from economic opportunity and development. By the late 1860s, the diamond was fast becoming a clerk's office. As they condensed power, the baseball magnates strove to exclude from the game, quote, any subject having a political bearing. In October 1867, the delegates at the Pennsylvania State Convention refused to rule on the admittance of the Pythian Baseball Club. 265 other clubs gained admittance into the association. In December, the club applied for membership in the National Association. The formal rejection from the nominating committee read as follows, quote, it is not presumed by your committee that any club who have applied are composed of persons of color or any portion of them. And the recommendations of your committee in this report are based upon this view, and they unanimously report against the admission of any club which may be composed of one or more colored persons. In 1870, the New York State Baseball Association used the bureaucratic powers at their disposal to erect their ban, using an amendment to a club election motion to propose that the association declare membership void for any club consisting of, quote, colored men. The motion and the amendment were passed unanimously. Regarding the International League, a timeline of events across the 1887 season will suffice. May 23rd, the Southern contingent on the Syracuse Stars intentionally botched plays to make black pitcher Bob Higgins look bad. Syracuse loses to Toronto 28-8. June 5th, Doug Carruthers and Harry Simon refused to be included in the Syracuse team photo if Higgins were to be in it. The photographer takes the picture without them. Management suspends Carruthers. June 28th, two white players on Binghamton refused to play with Bud Fowler and William Renfro. Fowler and Renfro, both black, were arguably Binghamton's best players at the time. The white players in question were suspended. July 1st, management reinstated the white Binghamton players. July 2nd, Fowler asked for and secured his lease from Binghamton after he signs a contingency clause stating that he would not sign with any other club in the league. July 14th, Cap Anson refuses to take the field with the Chicago White Stockings in an exhibition against Newark. If black players George Stovey and Fleet Walker play, the economic pull of the gate receipt and the two was too strong for the club and the fledgling league to ignore. Newark complies with Anson's racist demand. July 14th, the same day, in a secret meeting, the International League's board of directors instructs the league secretary to approve no more contracts with black players. November 16th, the International League folds, and minutes later, directors of the Buffalo, Toronto, Hamilton, Syracuse, and Rochester clubs formed the International Association. The IA continued the IL's policy of not approving new contracts with black players. Racist actions by white players created immense labor problems for the baseball magnates in the cash-strapped International League. Fowler's forced contingency clause gave precedent to the league's ban on contract approval with black players in July. The loss of potential profits at the hands of Anson reinforces the pressure of the commercial environment. As with the color barriers born in the internet, in the amateur associations, the International League used the levers of business to segregate the black player. In addition to the outright bans faced in the case of the Pythians, other business practices worked to segregate all black clubs from organized baseball. Sunday games meant everything to black clubs. The cartel of the National League in 1876 and the National Agreement in 1883 assisted the magnates and their clubs economically while shutting out competition for those clubs and players that stood outside the cartel. As part of compliance with the National Agreement, an affiliated club could not play on Sunday. For a team like the Cuban Giants, frequent local travel, heavy promotion, and Sunday games made all the difference to their bottom line. Sundays were where the crowds were. The Giants were often discriminated against in their attempts to play Sunday ball. Brooklyn's Daily Eagle noted an April 10, 1887 Sunday game between the Giants and Newark, during which Sheriff Mitchell of Newtown, Long Island, and his deputies descended upon Atlantic Park. The article in question is on the right here on the screen. The game was brought to a halt by the sheriff. The 4,000 paid spectators were, quote, indignant that the game continued, but eventually dispersed. They left the scene, quote, blue with angry words. Authorities stopped another game on July 10th between the Giants and Newark. The extensive promotion had led to a big crowd in attendance, but likely doomed the game from the start under Sunday blue laws. for the Cuban Giants and other all-black teams like the Gorhams of New York, the stopping of Sunday games, and the limitations of league-fixed schedules from the cartel restricted their revenue. It would make little economic sense for teams like the Giants and the Gorhams to drop Sunday ball and the revenues that came with it in order to join a national agreement affiliated league. Attempting to break through the established cartel was an immense economic burden for these clubs. Nevertheless, their integration efforts continued. July 1886, the Cuban Giants considered joining the Eastern League to replace the dissolved Meridian Club. The league rejected the Giants' application. Michael Lomax, in his landmark book, Black Baseball Entrepreneurs, 1860 to 1901, identified the Giants' reluctance to drop Sunday games as an influential part of the league's decision. 1889, the Cuban Giants and the New York Gorhams play in the Middle States League. The clubs played through a season filled with conflict and instability, only partially due to racism. The league was weak and volatile. Teams folded, new clubs joined, and as scheduling became sporadic, teams took guarantees and ran for the hills. S.K. Govern, the Giants' manager, said, quote, "Had I to do it all over again, I'd never enter the league." On October 9th, 1889, the Brooklyn Citizen wrote that the Giants claim the championship of the Middle States League. The league rejected the Giants' claim 5 days later. We can see the competing articles here on the screen. The league rejected the Giants' claim 5 days later, stating that they, quote, played most of their home games when and where they pleased. The league awarded the trophy to Harrisburg instead. The Citizen acknowledged the Giants' practices. These practices were advantageous and fair in their eyes as a black professional baseball club in a segregated country. However, the Giants did not fit into what organized baseball deemed proper. As such, they were punished with segregation. By the close of the 19th century, the business that was baseball had conspired to shut the black player and club out of the organized professional game. Freedmen's Bureau contracts set the stage for sharecropping, servitude, and other restricted forms of labor at the outset of Reconstruction, coinciding with baseball's commercial evolution. Frederick Douglass's dream of integration, that of absorption and assimilation into a blended race of all, was halted. As black players entered the amateur pastime in the professional game of the 1870s, the baseball magnates met them with red tape bureaucracy in the form of stall tactics, rules, policies, bans, and harassment. As a result, independent all-black clubs began to form, capitalizing on the breadth of available talent and the demand for well-played baseball. These clubs had to operate outside of organized baseball and thus adopt business practices that gave them the best chance at revenue. The magnates frowned upon these practices, like Sunday games, and punished teams like the Cuban Giants with segregation as a result. The initial business practices of the baseball magnates and the led black teams and players to operate as they did enforce segregation. While baseball's intentionality in bringing down the color barrier must always be acknowledged, honored, and celebrated, the intentional actions that built it must be reckoned with in our game's history. Casting off the origin of the color barrier in baseball as an informal, gentleman's agreement of immaculate conception does baseball, history, and American society little in the name of equity, reconciliation, and progress. Thank you. And we do have some time here at the end if there are any questions. Yes. At the time, little to no remedies would have been available to them, especially given the transient nature of professional baseball overall during that time. Teams were coming and going, as I said, taking guarantees and running for the hills. Scheduling was very sporadic for a lot of these leagues, like the Middle State League, like the Eastern League. Teams making it to the completion of seasons during that time were pretty rare. So in terms of legal, outlets for them, little to none would be available at that time. Yes.
On July 14, 1887, when Stovey and Leaper Walker were not allowed to play the game in Manson, the Cuban Giants defeated the Indianapolis team in the basketball game.
There we go. Yep. Yeah, I just said that on that July 14th date, who was it?
Cuban Giants.
Yep, Cuban Giants defeated Indianapolis Club.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So in terms of technically, yep.
And, so the York team didn't do what we don't end up doing 4 years, 3 years before.
Mm-hmm.
The York team conceded to Hanson, and they sat Stovey, and the decision was made in Baltimore on the same day, but that had more to do with being in Tennessee.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, yep. Yeah, so very often in the, take the location into context, Newark, these northeastern teams, the crowds were not often segregated. Black teams attracted a very integrated crowd often just because they were playing good baseball. They promoted themselves heavily. And often appealed to, especially working class fans, given their preference for playing on those Sunday games.
In terms of the economics of the game, can you comment on the availability or lack of availability of grounds available to clubs, and how that further impacted their ability to grow the game?
Yep. So. For all black clubs, they often played where they had any available grounds. As you can see, the Middle States League viewing this as a negative. They said that they played their home games when and where they pleased. The Giants were very much, at that time, a traveling outfit and played a lot, for instance, in Trenton, but, wherever there is a ground, they would attempt to find themselves and get a game going. Baseball grounds were, pretty plentiful during this time in terms of seating and structures, grandstands or whatnot, not so much. But they, would find parks and schedule games as often and as frequently as they could. In the Northeast, they were able to do that quite successfully. All right, with that, thank you for your time, everybody.